Red Dawn is our next film, and like Revenge of the Nerds, that is a terrific idea for a movie. Red Dawn is about World War III being fought on American soil when Russian and Cuban paratroopers land in a Colorado town. Now here's the terrific opening scene of the movie, set in a high school history class.
Well now, my friend. Well now.
All right, check it out.
All right.
You look pretty cool though, man.
I would say they were way off course. This is very unusual.
You can do something, Mr. Teasdale.
Georgie Ellis!
What's
Georgie
going on,
Ellis,
my friend?
Invincible!
No theoretical history lesson anymore. This is reality, and that is a shocking opening scene. Now, who's going to fight the commies? That's where Red Dawn comes up with another new twist. Who fights on screen? Not the U.S. Army. Oh, they help in the background. But the main fighters in Red Dawn are those same teenagers who organize themselves into a guerrilla hit-and-run fighting unit called the Wolverines.
And welcome to Who Will Save Generation X, the trivia game show that is dedicated to remembering, celebrating, and preserving all the wonderful qualities of Generation X through games, trivia, and friends. I am Zabe, the host of the show, and I am very excited to be back with our third format of the show that we've added to the podcast. It's a shorter version of the show that we can release in between regular episodes of home games, where it's just listeners versus the podcast to see how many points you can get. No prizes or ranks, just a quick mini game to satisfy that nostalgic itch for the pop culture of Generation X. We will also use this time to solve power struggles from previous episodes, as well as giving you a chance to help save Generation X from being forgotten in a special guest host segment of the show. To refresh your memory, here is the power struggle we're going to be solving at the end of the episode.
Mick, 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 speak English.
Prepare to qualify.
Catch!
Get ready for a surprise!
Do you remember where these five Gen X clips are from? Stay tuned to hear the answers at the end of the show. But for now, let's get right to the game that we call Who Will Save Generation X? Challenging Stage! Here's how the game works. We will have three fast-paced rounds of games to play and score points. In round three, we have a special guest host take over the show and quiz me for five questions. If you can get more correct than I can, then you're invited to use our website answer machine and mock me endlessly.
Don't call me stupid.
Oh, right! To call you stupid would be an insult to stupid people!
Or, better yet, use that answer machine to call in and take over as host for a moment and ask me some trivia questions that we can use on an upcoming episode. Just go to our website and click on that blue microphone icon and leave us five trivia questions that you think would work well on the podcast. It's 100% free to use, and it can be accessed from any device that has an internet connection and a microphone. We would love to hear your voice on the show. So, let's get going and save Generation X from being forgotten.
Round one.
For round one today, the judges put together a theme song. So let's hear a taste of it for the game we call Second Guessing.
Just a snip will make you think. Who's that artist in a blink? Play it twice, that tiny bit. Second guessing, this is it. Hey! Second guessing, only 1 second is all that you'll get. Second guessing, name the song and band from this little bit. Hey! Hey!
Really, judges? We haven't put out an episode in a month, so you can make a song, and that's what you came up with? I mean, don't get me wrong, I know polka music was really popular back in the 80s and 90s, but, can you come up with something a little bit better than that next time?
Hey.
Well, listeners, if you did not divine the rules of this game through that song, here's how we play. I will play 1 second of a popular song from Generation X, and you must guess the title and artist of the song. The judges have selected a recognizable 1 second clip of some part of a song for you to listen to, so it's not necessarily the first second of the song,
but it could be.
There are 3 songs in total, and you'll be awarded 1 point for artist and 1 point for title, for a total of 6 points available in the round. I'll play each clip twice and then reveal the answers at the end of the round. Let's start off with something really easy and get more difficult as we go. Song 1 is from 1982. and it is a new wave slash bubblegum song, according to its Wikipedia page. Artist and title of this hit song right here. Yeah. One more time. Yeah. We'll reveal the answers to all these songs at the end of the round, so let's move on to song two. Song two is from 1986, and it is a glam metal slash power pop song, according to Wikipedia. However, I think Wikipedia needs to Wikipedia what glam metal really means. I hope that helps you out. Here is 1 second of song number two. Listen up. Here's another listen to that 1 second clip. Did you get this one? If you didn't, you're going to be upset when we reveal it here in a moment. But for now, let's get to our final song of the round. Song three is from 1983, and it is listed as a synth pop, sophistopop, new romantic song, according to their wiki page. I am now over 50 years old, and this is the first time I've ever heard of a genre of music called sophistopop. However, after listening to the song with this genre in mind, it totally makes sense to me. The name of the band, however, does not. More on that in a moment, but first tell me the artist and title of this song. This is not the most well-known song from this band, but I'm sure the vast majority of Gen X have heard it many times. Here's your second listen. So how do you think you did in round one? Let's reveal the answers and find out. Song one. This is I Want Candy by the British new wave band Bow Wow Wow. See, I told you that was an easy one. Here's a fun fact. Most Gen Xers know that this is a cover from a 1965 band called The Strange Loves. Judges, no, just... Okay. However, this is a truly generational song. The Boomers had The Strange Loves version. Millennials had three different covers to pick from, recorded by the likes of Aaron Carter, someone called The Candy Girls, whatever that's all about, and even Sporty Spice did a solo cover of this song. We, of course, know that the Bow Wow Wow version should be known as the definitive version of the song, and that places it firmly within the property of Gen X. Judges? See? I told you. Bow Wow Wow may be known as a bit of a one-hit wonder in the United States, but they made history with their first single release called C30, C60, C90 Go. The song was the first ever cassette single and issued into the world the glory of the ka-single. The song is a love letter to a cassette tape, as you can imagine, with a title like C30, C60, C90 Go. That's a mouthful. And the lyrics celebrated recording songs off the radio. The record label refused to promote the single because of the hot-button topic of recording music off the radio, as if burying the song would somehow prevent Gen X pirates from plundering the radio for musical gold. So we here on the podcast salute you, Bow Wow Wow. Thanks for the ka-single and your contribution to our generation. I'd rather have a Bow Wow Wow ka-single than a Sporty Spice MP3 any day of the week. Here's song two. Did you get this one? You might be kicking yourself if you didn't. Song two, of course, is Living on a Prayer by Bon Jovi. Fun fact for this one is, written by John Bon Jovi, Richie Sambora, and hitmaker Desmond Child, the single, released in late 1986, was well received at both pop and rock radio stations, and its music video was in heavy rotation during the MTV days, giving the band their first ever number one on the Billboard mainstream rock chart and their second consecutive number one Billboard Hot 100 hit. Bon Jovi embodied the archetype of working-class heroes, which resonated more than ever in the 80s and helped imprint this song into the culture. Desmond Child offers some historical perspective in an interview, quote, "The message is, you work hard, you build your life, and you achieve the American dream," he said. He said, "You can make it." And Living on a Prayer says, "It doesn't make a difference if we make it or not. We've got each other, and that's a lot for love. We'll give it a shot." He goes on to say in the interview, "This whole aspiring thing, we're not going to give up. Even in the face of failure, we keep trying, and that's the American way. The whole idea of pull yourself up by your bootstraps and all of those ideas were there. There were a lot of people who didn't have some advantages and can't catch a break. But in the world of Bon Jovi, all things are possible." End quote. This said by the dude born in the 50s when you can pump gas for a living and raise a family on a single income. I would think that this message has not aged well by younger generations, and they would have a point. But I also like the idea of, in the world of Bon Jovi, all things are possible. Just don't think Tommy and Gina could buy a house today by working at the docks and a diner. And finally, song three. It's a classic. The song is called Gold by Spandau Ballet. Fun fact, Spandau Ballet is totally sophistopop. Even though I'm still not exactly sure what that means, it sure feels right. This song was their second hit after their more well-known song of True was heard on every radio station from here to London and beyond. Gold was an inspired take on the James Bond series of movies, particularly the film Goldfinger. I love this song, and it is a bit of a guilty pleasure of mine. It sounds like it belongs in a cheesy Las Vegas lounge act, and as we discussed already, it clearly sits square on the throne of sophistopop music. However, the band's name is nothing short of the heaviest of heavy metal. Spandau Ballet might sound flimsy, but they decided to name their band that name after discovering it scratched into a stall in a men's room at a nightclub in Berlin, and finding out it was a slang term used in the First World War by Allied war troops referring to the twitching corpses when hit by the German Spandau machine gun. Totally hardcore, and totally not what I would have expected to come from a band that sounds like this. Thanks again to the judges for their new theme song for this game. Stick around at the end of the episode where you can hear the entire song played there. We're going to take another listen to the power struggle for this episode, and then let's get back to some better trivia in round two.
Mick, 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 speak English.
Prepare to qualify.
Catch!
Get ready for a surprise!
Round two.
Round two of this episode is our Spotlight Trivia Round. We will dive into one Gen X topic to quiz you on. Each complete correct answer is worth 2 points if you know it outright, but if you need the hint or multiple choice, then it is worth only 1 point. I'll ask the questions and then circle back with the answers at the end of the round. Good luck! The Spotlight topic for this episode is the 1984 World War III film, Red Dawn.
Wolverines!
This 80s classic war movie is really unlike anything that came before it and stands alone against those that came after it. Just like the kids that are fighting all them commies did in this movie. See kids, back in the 80s we were told that the Soviet Union were unquestionably the bad guys. The communists were going to nuke us in our beds while we slept, and that the United States was the only one that could stop this impending doom upon us all. That didn't quite pan out the way we were fed in the 80s. But speaking as someone who lived in those days, this all felt like it could really happen. And that's one of the things that made Red Dawn so special in 1984. When you left the theater, it made you think of the real-world situations that we could possibly find ourselves in. This was clearly intentional because the movie was set 5 years in the future, in 1989, so they wanted us to think about these things in the present tense. Red Dawn was the brainchild of screenwriter Kevin Reynolds, who envisioned it as a fairly small-scale drama in the vein of Lord of the Flies with a staunchly anti-war sentiment. The studio didn't think he was the right person for the job, so after the Red Dawn project was declined by a number of other directors, it was ultimately accepted by John Milius, director of Conan the Barbarian and writer of Apocalypse Now. You see where I'm going with this. Known for his ultra-conservative political views and strong interest in military history, Milius set about to rewrite the script, radically changing its tone and content until it became something else rather than an anti-war movie. Once Milius was on board, it was decided to make Red Dawn the ultimate jingoistic movie. It reportedly was written by Milius using actual research on potential invasion tactics enemy forces might employ, according to the conservative think tank, the Hudson Institute. Milius drew heavily on the Hudson Institute data whilst rewriting the Red Dawn screenplay. The movie was initially titled 10 Soldiers, presumably because it's a story of 8 teenagers and one soldier fighting together during World War III. I mean, what else could it mean? It should be noted that this podcast is a non-political show, and we want to keep today's politics far away from anything we talk about here. We have enough of that junk everywhere we turn to these days, So rest assured, you're not going to be hit up with the political undertones of our day at this podcast. You're welcome. It must be said, however, that there are many that would, and do, point out the parts of this movie as clear political propaganda. I'm sure that they have a point and might even be right about some of it, but we are only interested in the pop culture relevance of this Patrick Swayze, Jennifer Grey, Leah Thompson, C. Thomas Howell war picture. This movie was amazing in its day, and the story of teenagers fighting off invaders to save their hometown and country was provocative, terrifying, and at certain points, heartbreaking. So, let's just set aside all the politics of this movie and just enjoy some good old fun trivia about a wholesome movie that portrays teenagers fighting a guerrilla war in the heartland of the United States during World War III. Here we go.
Question number one.
Red Dawn contains depictions and mentions of a war that include mass executions, nuclear weapons killing hundreds of millions, cannibalism, and a brutal scene where one teenager executes a fellow teenager with a machine gun. Your question is, what was this movie rated when it was in theaters in 1984? If you know it right now, you'll score 2 points, but here are the multiple choice options for 1 point. Was it A, PG? B, rated PG-13? C, rated R? Or D, it was released as a PG movie, but because of concerned parents, they changed it to an R rating after the second week of release?
Question number two.
What does Charlie Sheen's character Matt scream as he shoots an RPG at a Soviet tank in the Battle of the Snow that killed Aardvark and Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Tanner? But if you remember, the scene's pretty iconic. There's a tank warfare in the snow, and unfortunately Aardvark and Colonel Tanner die. Charlie Sheen's character Matt gets angry, picks up his RPG, and he yells this for 1 point. Is it A, eat me? B, burn? C, die, commie? D, Wolverines? Or is it option E?
Winning.
Question number three.
Patrick Swayze's character Jed has a signature weapon in the movie. He's often seen with a sniper rifle, but that was not the special weapon featured in the movie. What is Patrick Swayze's special weapon in this movie? 2 points if you can remember what Patrick Swayze whipped out as his special weapon. But for 1 point, here are your multiple choice options. Is it A, a Colt Peacemaker revolver with an ivory handle? B, a .44 Magnum revolver with hollow point bullets? C, a hunting bow he got from Mr. Morris's gas station? D, a Remington 572 Fieldmaster taken from the gun rack on the back window of his truck? Or is it E, a pottery wheel once gently used by Demi Moore?
Question number four.
The movie has an emotional depth that is missing from many action films of the era, and it is certainly missing from the 2012 reboot, I'll tell you that much. Yuck. One emotional scene is when Jed and Maddie go see their dad, played by the late great Harry Dean Stanton, at the drive-in movie theater turned into an internment camp. Their dad shares some memories of their upbringing as they say their final goodbyes to one another, and he asks the boys to do something on his behalf. Your question is, what is the final request that Mr. Eckert asks of Jed and Maddie? 2 points if you remember that final wishes of Mr. Eckert. But for 1 point, here are your multiple choice options. Is it A, I won't be able to pick you up at the swings at the park anymore, so you two need to look out for each other from now on? Is it B, don't ever cry for me, ever again. Don't do it for as long as you live. C, get out of here, boys, before they find you. And I love you too. Is it D, avenge me? Or is it E, go home and bring me back my copy of Escape from New York. The movie they're playing here really sucks.
America is a whorehouse where the revolutionary ideals of your forefathers...
And finally, question number five.
The final question of the round is, of the 9 Wolverine freedom fighters who fight off the Soviet Union and Cuba in the mountains of Colorado, how many are known to survive until the end of the movie? There were 9 cohorts featured in the film. How many of them live? 2 points if you know it right now. But for 1 point, here are your multiple choice options. Is it A, none survive? B, 2 survive? Option C is 4? Or is it option D, 69?
69, dudes!
Now that you had a little time to think about the questions, here are the answers. Question 1 was, what was the movie rated when it was released in theaters in 1984? The correct answer is B, PG-13. Red Dawn has the distinction of being the first ever film released with a PG-13 rating. I remember this clearly because I was only 11 when I snuck into the theater and saw it by myself. After this movie was released in 1984, the National Coalition of Television Violence deemed Red Dawn, quote, the most violent movie ever made, and they rated it an X. The coalition also gave X ratings to Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom all of that same year. While Red Dawn may have seemed mild enough to avoid a more restrictive R rating, it was by no means entirely family friendly. It may not have been particularly gory, but the film made the Guinness Book of World Records for containing the highest number of violent acts in a single feature film. Guinness calculated that Red Dawn averaged out at 134 acts of violence per hour, or 2.23 per minute, more than any other movie made at the time. An early DVD edition of the film played up this angle with an option for an on-screen body count tracker included in the special feature. Remember special features on DVDs? Those were rad. I miss those. Standards have changed over the years, and the violence here seems kind of mild by today's standards, so PG-13 seem about right, I guess. But I still think it's a bit out of line to show it on the channel I watched it last on. No joke, the last time I saw this movie, it was on the HBO Family channel, unedited. But I guess it's family-friendly in the same way that this podcast is family-friendly, so maybe I should just shut my mouth. Question two was, what does Charlie Sheen's character scream as he shoots an RPG at a Soviet tank? Option A, eat me, is the correct answer, if you can believe that or not. Eat me! The iconic line of Wolverines is only said three times in the whole movie, the most famous of which was Aardvark, as he held his weapon up over his head, and the second most famous was when C. Thomas Howell was gunned down by those creepy-looking Russian helicopters. To this day, fans still yell Wolverines at C. Thomas Howell. He says in an interview, I get that about twice a week in real life and about 40 times a day through Twitter. He says in real life, he doesn't shout it back, but on Twitter, he cannot help but type Wolverine with a few exclamation points behind it. So if you want to get C. Thomas Howell to at you, you know what to do. Wolverine! Question three, what is Patrick Swayze's special weapon in the movie? The correct answer was, option A, a Colt Peacemaker revolver with an ivory handle is the correct answer. In the movie, Jed's pistol was handed down to him by his grandfather, but in reality, the gun used in the film belonged to the director John Milius and was on loan from his personal arsenal. But it wasn't just his personal arsenal that was at his disposal. In the negotiations for making the movie, Milius was signed to direct at the fee of $1.25 million plus, quote, a gun of his choice. There were a lot of guns in this movie. Like, a lot. Reportedly, after Milius picked out his choice of weapon, he loaded it with live ammunition and carried the loaded pistol around on set with him during the filming. I don't think OSHA would allow that today.
You lose.
The RPGs used in the movie were just fabricated props altogether, utilizing a 1950s era RPG base, and a scope that was fabricated out of plastic was added. The rocket warhead is a plastic and rubber fabrication hooked up to guide wires. The fuse tip itself was a cap of a Crest toothpaste tube painted yellow. With this in mind, look it up in pictures and you can totally tell it is hilarious. Question four was, what is the final request that Mr. Eckert asks of Jed and Maddie? While Mr. Eckert says all of these options to his boys, the last thing he says was option D, avenge me.
Boys! Avenge me! Avenge me!
Okay, I guess he didn't say anything about Escape from New York, but Harry Dean Stanton is in that movie, and I'm sure that Escape was on his mind at the time, so we're going to let that one slide. While there are many emotional scenes in the movie, this is probably the most emotional one of all the actors filming it. When Swayze's character Jed cries and says goodbye to his father, he is really crying there. He stated that those are real tears for his real father because he never got to say goodbye to him before he passed away. In the film, Mr. Eckert talks about he was hard on them growing up and did things that made them hate him at the time. Jed, very hesitantly, tells his father that he loves him, and you get the sense that this might have been the first time that they ever heard their father say that he loves them too.
Go get going now. Get out before they find you.
Dad? I love you.
I know you do, son. I love you too.
His final request of Avenge Me fuels the brothers' efforts during the insurgency for the rest of the movie. Avenge Me are about as badass of a final request that anyone can give. Knowing my dad, however, his final request might have been something more along the lines of, pull my finger. Question 5 was, how many Wolverines are shown to survive until the end of the movie? The correct answer is option B. Only 2 Wolverines are known to have survived World War III. Aardvark was shot by Russian soldiers in the snow. Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Tanner was blown up by Russian soldiers with a grenade, as we said earlier, in that same fight. The mayor's son, Daryl, was executed by C. Thomas Howell for treason. He and Jennifer Grey were both gunned down by those creepy-looking Soviet helicopters. Those things really freaked me out for some reason. And finally, Jed and Matt Eckert were assumed killed when they made their diversion attack in town so that Danny and Leah Thompson's character, Erica Mason, could sneak through the enemy lines and get to safety. The scene where Jed and Matt sacrifice themselves for their friends is truly heartbreaking and powerful. In a movie that asks you to really suspend your disbelief and was written and directed by a really kooky dude who's carrying around a loaded gun all the time while he's looking at all the replica Soviet weapons, thinking about which one he's going to take home with him, as if he's one of the kids from Willy Wonka's chocolate room thinking about what treat he's going to eat next, they managed to turn in a gut-wrenching scene where Patrick Swayze, mortally wounded, propping up his dying little brother, Charlie Sheen, on a bench at the park where they used to play on when they were kids. Jed is talking to him, but really just to himself, trying to care for his younger brother and soothe him, telling him to just hang on and that Daddy will be there soon to take them home.
Come on, man. Daddy be here, sir.
I know this movie is violent and problematic in places, but the raw and real emotions in this scene always get to me. There is a moment in this scene where the Cuban general comes face to face with Jed and Maddie, gun drawn, and could easily shoot them without resistance. He looks in their eyes and realizes the futility of war as he lets them pass.
Vayan con Dios.
It is at this moment where it shows that at the end of the day, there's only one thing worth fighting for, our loved ones. The two brothers just sit there, alone in the park, holding each other, as the last bit of warmth leaves their bodies. And it fades to black, and we're left to presume that they both die.
Hold you as long as you can, man. Hold you as long as you can. You lean on me. Bro, I'm so tired. So tired.
Okay, now that everyone is bummed out, let's move on to round 3.
Round 3.
I am the guy who normally asks the questions, but in this segment, we're going to turn things around and have one of our listeners ask the questions to see if I can do my part to save Generation X. Our special guest host this episode is a For Realsies Quizmaster. He's the host of a national live pub trivia event. I'm super nervous to see what tough trivia he has in store for me. But please welcome this guest host all the same for this episode, Mike. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, this is awesome. Gen X needs to be saved. The culture is there. It is worthy. And it is far better than anything that's come since Gen X.
I agree. Super biased, but I agree.
Yeah, but it's true. Those are the facts.
All right. So you got some trivia for me.
All right. Question number 1. Most people think that Jane Wiedlin, the guitarist for the Go-Go's, made her motion picture debut as Joan of Arc in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. However, she made her film debut 4 years earlier, named the film and the role.
Wow.
I have a hint for you if you need the hint. Oh, and I won't deduct points. So
I'll take whatever hint you got, because top of my head, I just got a wild guess.
All right. Your hint came out in 1985 and it had multiple endings. And depending on where in the country you saw the film, you got a different ending. And then when it was released on video, it had all the endings.
Well, when it comes to alternate endings, I think of 2 movies immediately.
All right.
The super geek in me thinks of King Kong versus Godzilla, where in American audiences saw King Kong get the upper hand over Godzilla. But in Asian markets, Godzilla got the upper hand over King Kong, because I don't think Jade Wiedlin was in King Kong.
She was in the suit.
Yeah, she was cut
in
out.
The short.
Right. The only other movie has to be Clue then.
Yeah, that's the movie. What was her role?
It's been a long time since I've seen this movie, but I seem to remember there being like a scene telegram.
That's it.
That comes to the door. Is that it?
That's it. That's it. Yep.
Nice.
Awesome. Very cool. all right. Because when I was on the podcast, you know, one of my disqualifiers was that I was not a big fan of Prince. But this is a question about Prince. The musical genius of Prince left us with a plethora of songs.
plethora.
But not only did he write songs for himself, he shared his musical genius with other artists. So your question, can you name the top five charted songs written by Prince but performed by others? And we are using Billboard's Hot 100 chart and a Rolling Stone article that kind of talked all about it. There are 15 songs on this list. If you can name four, I'll give you full points because some of them are very obscure, but some of them are not. So,
okay. The most famous that comes to mind immediately is Nothing Compares to You and performed by Sinead O'Connor.
That was a number one, charted in 1990, and it came out 5 years after he recorded it for a different group. So that is the number one. That's the only number one on the list.
Is the list ranked?
Yeah, I've got them in order that they ranked on the top 100. That was the number one. So good deal.
So if I get none from going forward, I at least got the number one on the list.
At least got the number one, yes.
I'm giving myself a soft place to land here because I feel like I'm going to run out of titles real quick. I mean, he wrote so many that were made famous by other people. Did he write? There's a Sheila E. song. Mm-hmm. I'm having a hard time coming up with the title. What's that Sheena Easton song?
There is a Sheena Easton song also.
I know. See, I know he wrote for Sheena Easton. I know he wrote for Sheila E. I just can't think of the titles. Was Sex Shooter by Vanity Six on this list?
Oh, there is a Vanity Six song. It is not the one you just said, though. It was Nasty Girl. It came out in 1982. It didn't chart on the Hot 100, but it was number one on the U.S. Hot Dance Club Play, whatever that list is. So,
yeah, I'm flaming out here, Mike. I don't think I'm good on this list. Manic Monday.
Yes, 1986.
The Bangles.
Chart position number two. It's hard.
This one's hard for me because he was so prolific and, you know, you can name just about anybody. It seemed like you never really know because my memory was at least like he wasn't running around bragging about, oh, I wrote this song. I wrote that, you know, like he let these artists shine on their own, at least from my perspective.
Yeah.
Because I had no idea. Chaka Khan.
Chaka Khan.
Yep. There you go.
Chaka Khan, I feel for you.
Yeah.
Chaka Khan.
How could I forget that one?
I'll give you a half point on Sheila E. It was The Glamorous Life, 1984.
Oh, yeah, I would never come up with that title.
The other one was A Love Bazaar. That was 1985.
Oh, yeah.
The Sheena Easton one, I'll give you a half point for that. Sugar Walls, 1985.
I wouldn't have gotten Sugar Walls. Or the song either.
No,
I think I'm out.
This group, I'm shocked you didn't get this group. I'll give you the title and the year. See if you can get the group. The title is Jerk Out from 1990. And the other one they had was Jungle Love, 1984.
That's by Morris Day and The Time. Yeah, I ejected a little early on that one. I think I could have got Jungle Love. I was just getting flustered because it was taking so long to come up with the answer. That's a bummer that I missed that one. I'm going to be kicking myself for a while on Jungle Love.
It's all good. Yeah, but you did good. You did good. Question number three, the band Guns N' Roses has had several members pass through its rank in their time performing and recording. Not unlike the exploding drummer rotation of members in Spinal Tap, original drummer Steven Adler was removed from the band after their first two albums for his continued struggles with substance abuse. Adler was replaced by Matt Sorum, who was the drummer of another rock band in the late 80s. Can you name that British rock band and the title of their number two charting song from 1989?
Well, it wasn't Def Leppard.
No, they keep that drummer. So
yeah,
that one's actually kind of harder now that I read it out loud. So
yeah, can you read the details of that again? So I'm looking for Matt Sorum's British band.
British rock band and the title of their number two charting song from 1989. I think they're kind of a one-hit wonder. They probably have other songs that people know, but this is definitely their big, big, big song.
1989. Okay. So that's before Use Your Illusion came out.
Yeah.
British rock band had a number two song in 89, possibly a one-hit wonder. Working. There's a band that comes to mind, but I don't even know if they're British or if they had a whole lot of hits. It's the only thing coming to my head right now. I don't even know if I'm right. My guess. You got to guess something that you know and not just taking wild stabs. So when I think British rock bands, I think Def Leppard immediately, but they were nowhere near a one-hit wonder. And their drummer is far too famous to be mistaken for Matt Sorum. Was the Scorpions a British band?
I'm not sure about that, but it's not the Scorpions.
Okay.
It is a one-word name with the blank.
The Scorpions?
No, it's The Cult and Fire Woman.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know The Cult was a British band.
I didn't either until I wrote the question, but I knew that he was the drummer, so.
Yeah, they had more than one hit, but Firewoman surely was their biggest.
That was their big one. It's a banger, too.
That's a great song. Yeah, I think the Scorpions were like Eastern European, like, I don't know. They're like from Yugoslavia or Germany or something like that.
I promise the next two are easier. So number four has a little bit of a lead in here. So Ken Berry has had a long career from recurring roles on Mama's Family on TV, starring in the Love Bug series of movies for Disney and a slew of other TV film appearances dating back to the early 1960s. A staple on the Sunday night Wonderful World of Disney, Ken Berry certainly made films that impacted Generation X. My favorite film of his is the subject of this question. In this 1978 film, Ken Berry stars with a stellar cast of 70s and 80s TV film stars. Easily one of my favorite childhood movies. So the question, can you name this Disney sci-fi film starring Ken Berry, co-starring Sandy Duncan, Harry Morgan, Roddy McDowell, McLean Stevenson, and featured Ronnie Schell as the voice of the titular character of the film, who was also named was Jake in the film? Disney 78 sci-fi with a bunch of people in it.
Well, my first thought was, when you said Disney and sci-fi, I thought of The Black Hole.
Oh, that's my favorite. Oh, that movie is so good.
But I don't think they have a title character in the movie called The Black Hole.
Correct.
So I'm going to throw that one out. Sci-fi, Disney, late 70s, Sandy Duncan.
Yeah, she's the love interest. She's the love interest.
I think of Sandy Duncan. I only think of Peter Pan.
Yeah.
Like she did a long run of Peter Pan on, mm-hmm. on like Broadway or something. I remember commercials for that called Teletron for your tickets. Ken Berry, I can picture his face. And you're saying Ken Berry plays the titular role?
No, Ken Berry's the lead. Ronnie Schell, he did a lot of other voice stuff. He was the voice of the...
Is this animated?
No, it's live action.
I mean, you don't hide Sandy Duncan behind animation.
No.
Set up some facts here.
The title character is an animal, if that helps. And that's why it has to have a voice from a human actor.
Oh, I see. There's a hint. You're right. This is not an impossible question. This is totally gettable. It is escaping me, though. I can see it. I can see the guy. Oh, this is killing me. I can see Ken Berry talking to some sort of... Oh, that's not... Is that sci-fi? Is that the Shaggy D.A.?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
No, that is incorrect. It's the Cat from Outer Space.
Walt Disney Productions, The Cat from Outer Space.
I'm serious.
I've never seen The Cat from Outer Space.
Oh, it's so good. It's so bad. It's so good. The cat is an alien. It comes in on a spaceship that crash lands, and his collar is like this jeweled collar that they have to go steal these other jewels so that the cat can make it go back. And just like Ken Berry and Sandy Duncan have a romantic interest, Sandy Duncan's cat falls in love with the cat from outer space. So... And the cat's name was Jake, so...
My name is Zunar J5/9 Doric 47.
You're a cat.
He's the cat from outer space.
I said I've never seen that, but now that you describe it, I think maybe I have.
Yeah, Harry Morgan is a army general. Roddy McDowell's the bad guy trying to steal the cat. And McLean Stevenson is Ken Berry's best friend. It's the star power of 70, 80s stars. It's just crazy.
Here's the thing about nostalgia and why this podcast maybe has a place in the world is because when you're reminded of things that are buried so deep in your memories of your youth, mm-hmm. and when they're revealed to you, the same, it's a weird feeling and sensation. You said just, Zabe, have you ever seen the movie The Cat from Outer Space? I instantly said no when you said that. But now that you said it, I think I have seen that movie. Everything you saying is totally familiar, and it's like itching some small part in the recesses of my memory.
Yeah.
And it feels good. Thanks for that. Yeah,
there you go. All right. Question number five. One more. You may remember from our Patreon introduction on a recent podcast episode, Dirty Dancing is one of mine and my wife's favorite movies. The film chronicles Jennifer Grey's character, Baby Houseman, as she learns about dancing, intimacy, prejudices, and how not all people are financially well off. Baby was named after a famous historical woman. Can you name this woman and what position she held? And if you give me the name or the position, I will give you full credit for this one.
Oh, boy. Once again, it's been a while since I've seen this movie. I have a theory that there's not a Gen X woman alive that doesn't love and revere Dirty Dancing, the cutting edge or
toe pick.
Yeah. Or girls just want to have fun. Yeah. If you're a Gen X woman, you've loved one of those three movies, most likely. And unfortunately, I'm not a Gen X woman. So this movie isn't as near and dear to my heart as it maybe should be.
Baby. I can give you a hint, but I don't think it would help. I'll give you the position and you see if you can get the name, because that's probably the easier way to go here, I think.
Okay, I'll always accept hints.
She was the first woman in the U.S. cabinet as the U.S. Secretary of Labor under President Franklin Roosevelt. She held it for 12 years, longer than any other Secretary of Labor, and created the Immigration and Naturalization Services. So that was the position.
Oh, well, clearly that's Rosemary. Yeah.
No.
Oh, I got that one right.
Oh, wow.
Did it cut out?
It must have cut out. You said, I think it did. You said Francis Perkins.
Francis Perkins, of course. No.
I think they say Frances like twice in the movie. And I think if I remember right, the fact that she's named after her comes in a voiceover, like at the very, very front end of the movie or something.
So. I'm confident there is some exposition about that. I just couldn't recall the information.
Yeah. I wouldn't have gotten that either. That's totally definitely gettable. Ellis. But cool.
Did I go like 1 for 5?
Let me see. I'm going to give you the first one, which you got. That was Clue, the singing telegram. You got the number one of Sinead O'Connor and Nothing Compares to You, with written by Prince. So I'll give you a bunch of points for that. And you did get Bangles' Manic Monday eventually. And that was number 2. So that counts. And the rest of those. So.
They were gettable, Mike. I'm not going to hang on any kind of excuses.
Yeah.
I did terrible.
So you got 2 of 5. You did not get the Cult Firewoman. That one was probably pretty challenging, but gettable. And then Cat from Outer Space, and then Francis Perkins from Dirty Dancing.
That was some challenging trivia, Mike. And I'm glad that we've elevated the difficulty level on this podcast from time to time. You have definitely fit the bill for that. So I appreciate that.
Sure thing. It was fun. It was fun writing those, and I appreciate the opportunity to do that.
Thanks so much.
If you would like to try your hand at guest hosting this segment and share your trivia knowledge of the fun things of Generation X, just like my buddy Mike did here today, send the judges an email at whowillsavegenx@gmail.com. Or, even better, go to our website at whowillsavegenx.com and leave us a message. Just tap on that blue microphone icon on the lower right part of your screen and leave us that message. It's free to use, and your voice might be used on an upcoming episode of the show. Speaking of which, we still don't have a cool name for this guest host segment. If you can think of a fun Gen X name to call it, that would be something cool to leave us on the answer machine. We set this up specifically to get you asking us some Gen X pop culture trivia questions for the show. But really, anything you have in mind about the show, our generation, or whatever you want to share with us is free game on the answer machine. It's made for you to use, so please join us and get your voice on the show. We look forward to hearing from you. The last segment of the challenging stage is to give answers to the power struggle from past shows. But before we do that, let's hear a quick word from our sponsor.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
The magical world of Disney will return after these messages.
Hey! Have you ever thought about giving us a positive review on the podcast platform you found us on? We found listeners who have on Apple Podcasts, and Automobile writes and says, Zabe is a great host. The format of friends/guests make for fun gameplay, and the audio drops make for lols. Thanks, Automobile.
Automobile.
I hope that drop gave you some lol. Reviews like this really help others find the show, so please spread the word about the podcast, and your review might end up on an episode just like this one was. We look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks so much.
Now back to the program.
The Power Struggle.
Before we leave, we're going to reveal the answers to the past show Power Struggle. In episode 32, Kevin versus Stefan, titled They Think He's a Righteous Dude, we had a power struggle question and it sounded just like this.
Mick, speak English.
Prepare to qualify.
Catch!
Get ready for a surprise!
All right, let's reveal the answers now. Clip one was from the game show $25,000 Pyramid. Judges, will we accept $10,000 Pyramid? Yes. Clip two was from the Whoopi Goldberg movie Jumping Jack Flash. Clip three was from the racing arcade game Pole Position. Judges, grow up. Next was from the musical duo Hall & Oates. The song was called Out of Touch. And finally, that was the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie Total Recall. We will reveal more Power Struggle answers on future episodes of The Challenging Stage. Well, that's it for this episode. We hope you enjoyed it. We welcome you to contact us and let us know what you think about it. Your feedback is always appreciated, and thanks again for checking out the show. We welcome you to share this episode with that special Gen Xer in your life and subscribe to the show for future episodes where we will once again ask the question, who will save Generation X? Later.
Red Dawn is terrific in setting up its premise, and it's also very clever movie marketing in this picture to have the teenagers doing the fighting, teenagers being the most frequent moviegoers. We've had teenage gangster pictures, teenage musicals, teenage comedies, now Red Dawn, the first teenage war film. The next teenage western is the next, I guess. The film just peters out at the end. A mixed review from me.
A real negative review from me, Gene. I think this movie is
corrupt from beginning to end. And one of the problems I have with it is that it makes a very definite political statement. In other words, people should have handguns. They shouldn't be registered. The commies will come in and get the handguns. And then what do the teenagers use? Machine guns and anti-tank missiles. Well, that's terrific. Maybe we should have those too. There is a whole right-wing ideology in this picture that the picture itself doesn't deserve because it doesn't make its arguments with any kind of attention to logic. There is nothing in this movie. There is not a scene in this movie that doesn't have the gravest logical flaws in it, starting with the possibility that America would be invaded by paratroopers. I doubt it. I think they were invaded at all and probably rather than everybody would be dead, and that'll be that.
But give the film at least the beginning of its premise.
Okay, I'll give it its premise. Give it the premise. We're invaded. Okay. Then I'll give it the next idea. Yeah. Teenagers are going to fight the Russians. How come these teenagers are so smart that the Russians and Cubans are constantly doing nothing more than standing there and being blown up? I believe it'd be more interesting if the teenagers had done things like steal their gasoline or let the air out of their tires.
Let me tell you.
Using
this movie, you and I both know that this movie is not about how teenagers would beat the Russians.
No, no, wait. Fantasy pandering to teenagers.
That's right. Yes. Like most movies that pander to teenagers, most movies pander to anybody. And this movie is saying, hey, kids, forget your little, let everybody in the world. Someday the Russians are going to come here. You may not believe that, I may not believe that, but this movie wants to play that. And I think it is so fascinating about what it would be like if that I was fascinated
for a while.
What it would be like if, because I'm going to be a movie in which realistic, convincing, plausible teenagers in this situation behave the way 15 and 16 year olds
behave. Okay, you know what it would be like?
They would behave in this movie, they'd behave like John Wayne.
No,
behave.
No.
Because your movie, the reality, would mean a short subject. They'd be blown away.